Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Have a great guest here. Another one in the lineup that you've had. It's been fantastic. His book, Escaping the Rabbit Hole, and it's how to debunk conspiracy theories using fact, logic, and respect. Came out September last year, and I've just started listening to it. Fantastic. Mick West, thank you for being here.
I'm very glad to be here.
So, Mick, how do you debunk these theories using respect?
Well, the respect part is all about establishing effective communication with people. You know, it's very easy to debunk a conspiracy theory on a factual basis, just examining like the claims and then pointing out where they're wrong. But the difficulty that arises on how do you communicate this this explanation, this debunk, to the people who actually believe in the conspiracy theories. And the way to do that is by talking to them in a way that they don't push back against you. And to do that, you've got to give them a degree of respect. Now, that doesn't mean you have to pretend to agree with them. You can explain to them that you don't agree with them. But you've got to kind of respect that from their point of view, this theory seems to make sense, and then you've got to try to figure out why it makes sense to them, and then try to work from there.
So this is sort of a big deal that you're working on, because, you know, in my work, I try to study why people believe these things that they do. Mm-hmm. But people always ask me, so what do you do to change somebody's mind? And at that point, I just sort of throw up my arms and say, I don't know. But what are some of the rhetorical strategies that a person might use if they have a family member who's, you know, gone down the rabbit hole, per se, and wants to sort of bring them back?
Right.
Like, is there any magic bullet? Is there a strategy? I mean, I understand being respectful, but what would that entail more specifically?
Well, first of all, you've got to get past the defensiveness. Because there is this stigma of being a conspiracy theorist, and to some degree, rightfully so. Like, it is, you know, a lot of these things are ridiculous theories. But if you come into that saying, yeah, this theory is ridiculous, I'm not going to listen to it, I'm just going to, like, tell you what the real thing is, then you get this pushback. So you've got to get past that initial pushback. And the way to do that is kind of like with kid gloves. You've really got to take your time. You can't just go in and start telling them it's ridiculous. You've got to ask them questions. Let them explain to you why they believe what they believe. And really what you're trying to do there is try to determine two things. You try to determine, first of all, what common ground you have, because you really want to build the conversation on common ground. So you try to find things that you both agree on. Like you might both agree that there's a lot of corruption in the government, and that that we shouldn't trust politicians, you know, which is a kind of a thing that most people would agree upon. And then the second thing is that you have to try to find where they draw the line. You have to find the things that they don't actually believe in, and then find what's the closest thing to that that they do actually believe in. And then you can focus in on this line, which I call the demarcation line, which is a line between things that they think are ridiculous pseudoscience and conspiracy theories and things they think that are very, very reasonable. And if you find that line, it gives you an area in which you know that what you are saying can tip the balance. If you don't focus around that line, you could be focusing on things that they're going to dismiss anyway, or things that are very, very solid in their belief. So you've got to kind of find an edge in a way. So focus on things that they might be persuaded on, rather than things they definitely won't be persuaded upon.
So I tend to find that people, you know, they cluster their conspiracy theories around people that they don't like. So it's people on their side are never guilty of anything, and if they are, it can be explained away. But people on the other side, you know, they're the bad ones, and it takes significantly more evidence to sort of let those people off the hook. Do you seem to find that in your work, that people are very selective with who the villains are?
It kind of depends on how extreme the conspiracy theory is. When you're talking about things as extreme as, say, chemtrails or the flat earth conspiracy theory, you don't really get this kind of polarization. You get, obviously, people thinking that the people in power are the ones responsible for it, but you don't get the type of political polarization that you get in some theories. For example, the 9/11 conspiracy theories were very biased in demographic terms to Democrats in the early years of the theory, because obviously the Republicans were in power at the time, and so they thought this is evil plot by Bush and Cheney. Now, there's still a certain degree of that, but it's kind of shifted away now because we've had administrations that have been, we had the Obama administration, and nothing got done in terms of revealing the secrets of 9/11. So now I think it's shifted over more to just distrust of the government rather than distrust of one political party.
Yeah. So how do you deal with something like chemtrails? So, you know, I never thought about chemtrails that much. I thought it was ridiculous on its face. I didn't know why I thought that until somebody said to me, you know, if you were going to put poison up in the sky, you know, to brainwash people or whatever the theory is, it's the worst way to do it. Because almost anything you put 30,000 feet up in the air is going to wind up in the ocean and not really having the intended effect. So is that sort of something that you might give to a chemtrail conspiracy theorist?
No, okay. You wouldn't. In fact, that's actually a great misconception about the chemtrail theory. The chemtrail theory isn't about putting poison in the sky and poisoning people. That's kind of a subset of things that, like, a few people believe, you know, the type of people who believe the government is trying to put nanorobots in our blood to control us. But the majority of people who believe in the chemtrail theory think that it's a covert form of geoengineering. Okay. They think it's the government trying to alter the climate, and it's something to do with global warming. Opinions vary on whether they're trying to create global warming or try to prevent a global warming catastrophe secretly. But basically, it's all about this theory of climate change and global warming. So if you start out talking about, you know, they wouldn't poison us and it would spread too far, then you kind of lost them, because they probably didn't think that anyway. Okay. So you've got to, this is, you know, why it's important to listen to the conspiracy theorists and ask them, you know, what is the actual theory that you believe in, because there's variants of these theories. You know, with other things like 9/11, there's lots of different variants. So in the chemtrails, there's a few different variants, but this is the main one. So the chemtrail theory is based on a few very specific misconceptions, and those are the things you want to try to address with people. And the main one is that contrails cannot persist. People think that normal contrails should quickly fade away, And if they don't, then it's a chemtrail. And the way I address that is I show them old books on the weather. I've got a collection of old books on the weather and books on clouds. And they all discuss, all these books that I have all discuss contrails and their formation. And these are books going back to the 1940s. And every single one of these books say that contrails sometimes disappear quickly and sometimes can persist for a long time. And so if you show people this, you know, quite compelling evidence, this is something that actually does make them think. And I've heard a lot of people actually tell me that this one, it's actually a video I made showing all these books, was actually quite instrumental in getting them to realize that chemtrails wasn't a thing.
So couldn't your ardent conspiracy theorist come back and say, well, you know, this just shows that they've been, you know, up to this since the 1940s.
They do. And in fact, some of them go back even further. They will quote, what's his name? The famous scalar technology scientist. I can't think of his name right now, but they go back, you know, to the early days of science and say, oh, this might have been going on in the late 1800s even. And if you show them a photograph from the late 1800s of clouds, you know, the very earliest photos of clouds, sometimes you get photos of ripples in the sky, and they think ripples in the sky are an indication of what they call scalar technology, which is exemplified by the HARP conspiracy theory nowadays, which is about this big radio transmitter in Alaska. And then they will, because they're so involved in this theory, they will say, oh, well, you know, it must have been Tesla back in the 1800s doing this. But that's a small minority. You know, it's the kind of the extreme cases in the conspiracy theory. Most people, when you show them things like all these books on clouds, will actually respond fairly well. It'll give them something to think about.
So I'll throw a little bit of data at you. So I did some polling here in Florida last year, and we asked people if they thought the government could control the weather, and specifically if they could control things like hurricanes and tornadoes and whatnot. And we had about 15% of Floridians say yes, and another 20% not sure. So it seems like there's a lot of people who are either, you know, convinced of this, or at least, you know, need to be convinced the other way, that this is a true thing. Like, what would you say to somebody like that? I mean, do you just come out and say, you know, the government doesn't create hurricanes and then send them to get you? Is there some other strategy?
What I would do there is try to get them to look at the actual state of the research into things like controlling hurricanes and controlling the weather. I mean, you know, we can actually control the weather in a small way by cloud seeding. This is something that's been done commonly since the 1950s. I don't think you do it in Florida, but it's certainly something that's done here, like very close to where I live in the northern Sierras of California. It's quite commonly done. They do cloud seeding with small planes. They spray chemicals into the sky, and it makes the clouds rain a bit more or snow a bit more. At least that's the theory. I mean, this is something that's actually being done. And there have been experiments trying to steer hurricanes. There was an experiment called Project Storm Fury, which I believe was in the 60s or 70s. It was quite a while ago. And they tried dropping, I think, the same thing against silver iodide into hurricanes on one side to try to make it go in a certain direction. But they found that they really couldn't control the direction of the hurricanes. And because there's so many issues with accidentally getting the hurricane going in the wrong direction, they basically gave up on that idea. But if you look at what's actually being done, I think it gives you a good perspective on what is possible. And you know, when people say, can the government control the weather? There's a certain amount of truth in answering yes, because the government could decide to do lots and lots of cloud seeding, and it would actually change the weather in a small way in certain areas. So I think you have to be quite careful with a question like that, because the person answering it will have a very different understanding of what it's mean. What you mean? Do you mean control every aspect of the weather 24 hours a day all year round, or do you mean occasionally alter a little bit of the weather?
So I've had some emails recently, and maybe you could help me out with this, but the first one I got was from a family, and their son had had a college degree, a good job, and then decided to quit his job and his career in finance and move home into the parents' basement to be a QAnon YouTuber.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that this was important for him to do because there was going to be a great awakening, and the public was going to need his help to understand everything that was going to happen. So he needed to be ready for this. So that's on one thing. And they were very concerned that the son had been brainwashed into some sort of cult and didn't quite understand what was going on. And then the other, I had a woman emailing me, telling me her husband had become a QAnon conspiracy theorist, and I think she was looking for a way out of the relationship. I didn't want to carry on that conversation too much further than that. Well, all I said was, I don't really know what to tell you. You probably know him better than I do. What's the sort of thing you would say to families in these instances where they think the person has just gone too far in, and it's not just, you know, arguing one theory anymore, but it almost what would seem to be an entire lifestyle?
Yeah, it's a very difficult situation. You know, when you've got a family member, you know, sometimes I think the easiest thing and perhaps the best thing is just to let them do their own thing. You know, if they're not bothering you too much, just because they hold these very strange ideas that you completely disagree with, then, you know, perhaps it's best just to let them run with it for a while. Now, with QAnon in particular, QAnon is something that's going to be time limited. It is going to morph over time, but a lot of the QAnon stuff is about making very specific predictions about the future. There were all these sealed indictments that are going to be released, or the Mueller report was going to result in the arrest of the Hollywood evil elite. You know, things that were predicted that didn't come to pass. It's not something like 9/11, which is theories about something in the past. This is a theory about something essentially in the future. And if it doesn't come to pass, then a lot of the people who believe in QAnon are just going to realize that there's nothing to it, and they will move on. Now, of course, yeah, I don't know what's going on with these individuals, so it's very difficult to give any specific advice. But my basic advice is always to try not to alienate the person. Try to listen to them, with respect but with disagreement, and try to figure out why they believe what they believe. And the more communication you have with people, the better the end result is going to be. You talked about cults, and if you look into the advice that people give to family members or people who are in cults, I don't really think of QAnon as a cult, but there's some similarities. The advice that experts in cults give is just simply to keep talking to that person. You've got to keep some degree of being grounded in reality, but you've got to be careful not to lose that link with them. So you have to tread lightly, but keep going.
Because that could essentially be the only link they have outside of their little network, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, the family link can be a very strong link, and it can, to a degree, override some of these disagreements. And you have to give it time. You know, these things can take a long time. You know, don't get disheartened because, for months even, nothing might seem to be happening. If you have that link and you keep communicating, that does seem to help, and that does seem to be something that is a common thread in people's stories that I've talked to about how they got out of the rabbit hole, is that somebody helped them out.
See, in this particular case, it's sort of, obviously the family is going to, the kid was moving home, so he was going to remain in contact. I guess something I thought about in the short term was, if you join, the Kennedy conspiracy theory movement and you are, putting out Kennedy conspiracy theories, that's not that big of a deal because that seems to be a majority belief, at least in the U.S. But if you are actively engaging in QAnon conspiracy theories on YouTube and there's an open record of you doing this, those theories are not just fringe, but they're really sort of wacky stuff when you're talking about Hillary Clinton's running a satanic child sex ring and people who come out and say this is true, I can only imagine what kind of negative consequences this would have on them later in life when they apply for jobs or whatnot.
Yeah, that's true. People, obviously from their perspective, though, they don't see it like that. They see it as they're part of this movement that is going to have a revolution soon, so they're going to be on the right side of history. You know, they figure that, you know, once Q has been revealed as being this savior person, then, you know, they'll win, and they'll be worse off if they didn't do anything. So, you know, it's not really an argument you can use with them. You could say, perhaps, you know, what if you are wrong? But since they're so deeply convinced that they are right, you know, that's not really an argument that's going to run with them.
So how about issues where you have husbands and wives sort of disagreeing about issues like this? Is, you know, obviously they have to communicate with each other, or else mm-hmm. the marriage is going to go down the tubes pretty quick. How can they get over something like this? Is there something one spouse can do to the other? I mean, obviously they have to be somewhat sympathetic and open to communication, but I think, you know, being in that sort of tight relationship would also present its own sort of pitfalls.
Yeah, that's a tricky one. But I think a lot of times you do get couples who, for example, have different political beliefs. One could be conservative and one could be liberal. And they manage to work it out. They understand each other's differences, and they live with it. You know, all couples are not made up of people who are identical. You're always going to have some differences with your spouse, your partner. And so a lot of people manage to work with those differences. Because if you love someone and you respect them, even if you disagree with them, you're still loving, like, you know, a whole bunch of them, a whole bunch of that person, but there's a little bit of them that you disagree with. So people can work around it. Obviously, though, it could well become a problem if you don't have that, you know, very solid fundamental relationship, and you start arguing all the time about these things, then, you know, it's going to lead to problems. But yeah, I don't think that's entirely something that's specific to conspiracy theories. You know, people break up all the time because of differences, and you know, maybe they're going to break up because of their conspiracy theory differences. But you know, maybe also it's something that you can fix to a degree by talking to them about it and trying to bring them around. It varies a lot by individual. You can't really give generic broad advice for this.
Now, what if somebody was believed in 9/11 truth conspiracy theories? Now, as you mentioned earlier, I mean, these used to poll around 20-25%, but they've, in some polls, they're making an upswing. I would say because more Republicans are starting to believe in these theories now than mm-hmm. used to. I have found that the 9/11 truthers are the most difficult people to talk to. They're just absolutely convinced of their beliefs and of their righteousness. And probably of any conspiracy theorists, the ones I don't want to talk to ever. I find the alien believers to be the nicest people, strangely
really?
Enough.
That's
what do you do with somebody? What do you do with a 9/11 truther? How can you engage with them in a productive way? I mean, that theory seems to be one that's just very, it just gets people, it gets them angry.
I try to focus on the more scientific aspects of it. If you try to get into things like the motivation and the politics and things like that, and you know, the insurance and, you know, the more indeterminate type things, it's a bit fiddly. But if you can get into things like how fast the buildings collapsed and what was in the dust afterwards, you know, a lot of these people are actually really interested in these, you know, arcane topics. I did this talk on iron microspheres. And that is something that, you know, people who were 9/11 truthers found to be quite reasonable. Some of them, like I said, it changed their minds about that piece of evidence. On my podcast, I just had an extensive 2-hour interview with a 9/11 truther who used to be a hardcore 9/11 truther, and he's now kind of wavering, and in large part because he's been talking to me and like listening to my stuff. And, you know, he would have taken the iron microspheres evidence as being solid before, but because I kind of explained to him patiently and carefully, you know, why it actually isn't evidence, he's shifted. It takes a long time, though. I started talking to this guy like nearly 2 years ago, you can't just give people the evidence and expect them to flip. You have to kind of give them time so you can give them the evidence and let it, like, you know, grow a seed, or you keep working on them. But it takes a long time. But yeah, you talk about them being the worst to talk to. I haven't really had that experience. I get a lot of bad... Actually, I've got a lot of... the worst reactions I've had have actually been from the alien people, which is kind of the opposite of you. I think it depends who you talk to. You know, a lot of these theories, they're populated by kind of two groups, one of which is often old men, especially in the 9/11 truth community. A lot of the people, like the architects and engineers for 9/11 truth, they're like old guys who are retired, who've got nothing better to do. Mm. And then you have the younger, more diverse groups of people who are much more emotional about the topic, and those are the ones who are going to call you names. But yeah, I've had some very good conversations with people in the 9/11 truth community, and I think a lot of them are open to good discussion.
I mean, that's been my experience with the 9/11 architects and engineers, is that it tends to be people who are retired or not active engineers anymore. But what's so funny about that group to me is that people look at it as if, you know, this is an authoritative source of information.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
So must be all architects and engineers have come to this conclusion. And one thing I point out to people is that, you know, they have, you know, less than 1,000 members, I think is what it said on the website last time I checked. But there's some number of millions of engineers and architects in the country.
Exactly.
So we're talking about a tiny subset of people here. So let's switch this a little bit. So a new one that keeps popping up quite a bit is the flat earth idea. I don't know how many people believe this, but it gets a lot of media play, and there's a pretty neat documentary on Netflix about it, about these folks. I mean, if you bumped into any of them, and how would you convince someone who thinks the earth is flat despite all the evidence, you know, that they could be wrong?
It is a very tricky thing to do. I'm actually going to speak at a Flat Earth conference on May the 26th in Las Vegas, which is going to be a very interesting experience. They invited me because they wanted to show that they're open to all ideas, but Flat Earthers, as you know, are some of the most resistant people when it comes to contradicting their beliefs. And part of the reason is they basically reject every single argument from authority, which means they basically reject all of science. So it makes it very difficult to actually give them an explanation for something based on science. Some of them even reject mathematics and trigonometry as being some kind of instrument of the devil. But they really want to have evidence that they can see for themselves. So with that, I try to focus on things that you can actually go out and look at yourself. Like if people are in Los Angeles, for example, I will always encourage them to go down to the beach, you know, any of the beaches down there on a clear day, and look at Catalina Island. You know, take a photograph of it from the beach, take another photograph of it from higher up, say on the cliffs of Santa Monica. And you will see that there's a difference between what you see low down and what you see high up, which shows that Catalina is being hidden behind the curve of the Earth. If you give them these practical demonstrations, that can be compelling. However, what happens is the more practical demonstrations you give to them, the more excuses they make, the more convoluted their theory becomes. They will talk about how it's actually a function of perspective, or it's a function of the light bending, or it's a combination of perspective and refraction. So if you give them an explanation, they will layer something on top of that to explain that explanation, and you'll give them some other explanation using something completely different, like, for example, the observation of the stars rotating around the southern celestial pole, which would be basically impossible on a flat Earth. Then they will try to figure out some kind of weird way in which the light is bent through some kind of obscure atmospheric prism to explain that. So it's a difficult one, but the people who genuinely were into it and genuinely get out of it, it kind of varies. Like, some of them get out because they see the weight of the evidence really isn't in their favor. The guy that I interviewed for my book, he got out of it really because, not because he understood the evidence, but because he saw that the people on his side were just repeating the same things over and over again, and they were ignoring the responses. And he realized at some point that they didn't really have a solid basis for their argument. But it took him several years to get out. It's very tricky. And of course, it's very, very much conflated by the fact that people in that movement are not serious a lot of the time. They're just joking, they're just trolling. It's hard to say, like, how many people even in this conference that I'm going to will actually believe that the Earth is flat, or they just enjoy poking debunkers and seeing how they react.
So let me ask you a question. So what if you show up to the conference and convince everyone that the Earth isn't flat? What do they do for the rest of the conference?
Well, it's only 2 days, so, and it's in Vegas, so they can go out and have a good time.
That might serve them better than doing this. So one thing you mentioned, people can always find reasons to sort of reject whatever they want if they're motivated to do so. I mean, is there a way to sort of put those defenses down? Because I guess in some way, no matter the evidence, no matter how ironclad it is, people can accept it or not accept it, and they can come up with reasons. I mean, I imagine that if you speak at a Flat Earth conference, you're going to have people there who are just going to say you're some sort of NASA shill, or you're a satanic person trying to hide the true glory of God. How do you reach them? I mean, I know it's more difficult, but is there some way to get even past those mechanisms?
Yeah, I think what you've got to do is try to show them stuff that they were missing. There's a lot of the people who believe these theories, the flat Earth theories, they base it on very superficial evidence. They very, very quickly flit from one point to the next. And if you're just going down a list of points and you give them some explanation, then they respond and then you move on to the next one, you're not going to you're not going to make any progress. You really have to focus on individual points a little bit more and show them as much material as possible. Like some of them will point to photographs of the moon, for example, and they will show you like a crappy little photo that they took with their cell phone, and they will say that it proves something, like something about the brightness or how the angle isn't quite right of the shadow. But you can actually show them, you know, vastly higher resolution photographs of the moon, like and photographs I took myself. I could actually, you know, go out there with them and take a photograph of the moon and, you know, show them things like the shadows of the mountains of the moon. And if you show them that they're basing their information on very, very low quality information or photos or whatever, and there's all this other stuff that you could look at, all these like different things you can consider, then it really can have an effect. Like another thing I do is like encourage them to look at the International Space Station. A lot of them, they assume the space station is fake, obviously, because it's in space. But you can actually predict when the space station is going to fly over your house. And if you have a good enough camera, you can actually take photographs of the space station. And you can see the shape of it. You can see the shape of the solar panels. And if they've never thought about this before or never done it or never seen these photos, then seeing something new that they haven't seen before can actually nudge them in the right direction.
So do you think a lot of what's happening now isn't so much about conspiracy theory per se, but it's really about a rejection of expertise wholesale, where people say, you know, yeah, we have experts who study something, but who cares? Their expertise isn't really all that good, and those people at worst may be shills for some shadowy interest. I mean, could it just be that people don't want to listen to others anymore, and they have a lack of respect for the expertise that's earned with education and studying something?
I'm not sure about that. I think there is still a lot of respect for science. I don't have any numbers right to hand, but I've seen polls where, you know, people do like respect the opinions of scientists. I think what we're seeing more is an amplification of, you know, long-standing distrust of authority that's large in some circles. And I think it's being amplified in large part by social media and by YouTube. You know, there's a big problem with YouTube essentially working on an addiction model. And Facebook also working on an addiction model, which is something that they're trying to move away from, but it's still very much an issue. They try to figure out what will keep people reading things on Facebook or watching videos on Facebook or watching videos on YouTube. And the addictive videos for some people are these conspiracy theory videos. So I think, you know, this addiction model of social media is actually amplifying these tendencies that people have to distrust authority and manifesting as these conspiracy theories.
So I watched a YouTube video recently. I think it was filmed some time ago, but it's famed biologist Richard Dawkins, and he's having a conversation, or at least trying to have a conversation with a hardcore creationist. And there was just nothing he could say that was going to change her mind. And she said, strangely enough, she kept saying over and over again, if I saw the evidence, I would change my mind, but there's no evidence. And his response over and over again was, just go to a museum. It's right there in front of you. So in a case like that, is it that people just don't value evidence, or is that they're hiding from evidence?
Yeah, I think there's certainly a degree of that. But I think also it's very unrealistic to expect her to change her mind, even with, you know, Richard Dawkins being in the room with her. Like, people do not change their minds over one conversation. In fact, you know, probably it had the reverse effect, like a degree of backfire there, where because she was essentially under attack by Richard Dawkins, as she saw it, she would be you know, hardening her mind against his arguments, thinking that he was trying to trick her. Yeah, and the idea of like just saying, just go to a museum, that's not going to work. You know, you can't. People aren't going to go to a museum. You know, people say things like, why don't you take a class in physics, or, you know, study astronomy, and then you'll see the Earth is flat. You know, that's not going to do anything. No one's going to take a class in anything. So yeah, you can tell them the evidence is there, but really you have to show them that evidence. You need to actually take the time to figure out what it is they believe in and what is the evidence that they are missing, and then bring that evidence to them. They're really not going to go out and look for it themselves just because you told them to.
So is it the case that I could bring somebody books or information, or do I really have to demonstrate something to them? I mean, I guess I got an email last week. It went right into the – I have a folder called Kooks. And I tell my wife, I say, if I ever don't make it home one night, just go to that folder, and it's probably one of them has me locked in a trunk somewhere. But I was getting some late-night emails about people, you know, challenging me on snarky comments I've made about jet fuel melting steel and whatnot. And they want evidence to show that, you know, the planes really could bring down the towers.
Yeah.
And I don't even know how to engage that, and I, you know, I just shift it into another folder so I don't have to. But, you know, where could I go with something like that? Do I show them a book? Do I show them, you know, some reports that have been made, or do I have to blow up a building to show them what, you know, that it can actually fall?
Yeah, well, that's, yeah, the World Trade Center collapsing is a tricky one because the World Trade Centers were uniquely large, and you're not going to get anything that's analogous. But there are things you can show them. There's a great video by the National Geographic channel where they took a steel beam and they put it over a pit filled with jet fuel, and then they lit the jet fuel, and in just about 5 minutes or so, the beam sagged in the bottom, sagged down, and like collapsed. So there are actually demonstrations like that that people may not be aware of. And again, it's this thing like finding what are they missing? What are they missing that makes them actually give credence to these theories? And there are things that you can show them. If they believe in this iron microspheres evidence, you could show them my talk on iron microspheres. There's actually quite a few debunking videos on things like the speed of the collapse of the buildings. You can show them that. They like videos. Now, you think sometimes like you have to give them this short answer, but these are people who got into conspiracy theories because they watched videos that are sometimes several hours long, and they basically consume these videos. So they've probably got the time to actually watch videos, and so if you can give them a video that addresses a point that's pivotal in their misunderstanding, then that is something that can work. But again, it's something that's you have to give them time. You have to give it time for that to sink in. It's not going to take straight away. And you might have to show them 20 videos or give them, you know, books are okay if they're nice and straightforward, but you can't force someone to read a book. It's a lot easier to give them a link of a video. They might not watch it, but it's far more likely than showing them a book.
So I guess I find that when I talk to journalists, one of the thing that they often say to me is, well, how do you convince these people? Because they just can't be convinced. And I often say back, you know, nobody wants to be convinced of anything, conspiracy mm-hmm. theorist or not. It's not like you're going to put two people of different religions into a room and have them walk out with some consensus after a few minutes. It's just not going to happen. Do you think that when you're going after people's beliefs in these specific theories, are you just chipping away at that theory, or is there something bigger that you're chipping away at? I mean, is it just that, hey, jet fuel can melt steel, or is it that, you know, mm-hmm. the federal government doesn't kill 3,000 of its own people on a random Tuesday?
Yeah, it's a large... a large base of beliefs that they have. It's been referred to as a crippled epistemology, like a crippled knowledge system, where the way in which they think about the world is based on a limited set of information sources, and information sources which are often incorrect. It's like if you only got your information about the world from watching one highly polarized a news outlet like Breitbart, for example, which is a kind of a very right-wing outlet. you get this very crippled understanding of the world because you're only getting it from a perspective that what someone is trying to push a particular point of view. And that covers like a whole number of bases. It's not just simply things like the science. It is things like trust of government and perhaps a misunderstanding about the size of government and the size of the elite in the world. The one thing I do is I try to show people how many billionaires there are in the world and how diverse the actual wealth and power of the world is amongst the rich elite of the world. And people sometimes, you know, they think that there's just this shadowy elite of like 10 guys in a room somewhere in New York that controls the entire world. And if you try to broaden their perspective, try to give them a better grounding for an understanding of the world, that actually can be helpful, like trying to show them things like, you know, there are these rich people in China who are doing things. There's rich people in Russia who are doing things. There's a whole bunch of different rich people in the United States, including the tech billionaires, who are, you know, generally very different from the oil industry billionaires. So you don't have this homogeneous evil force that is ruling the world. You have this very chaotic, diverse bunch of people who are essentially running the upper parts of the world, and showing that to people gives them perspective.
This is perhaps one of the most annoying conspiracy theories that I run into, and it takes different forms. Like somebody might say the 1% controls everything, or it's the 0.1%, or but there's never been a lot of evidence showing that these people work together to achieve particular ends and actually get their way. I mean, I don't doubt that the richer somebody gets, the more power they can exert over the political system. But that's a very different argument than saying, you know, they control things in some concerted way with others like themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And the rich people are essentially working in their own self-interest and the interest of their family. And sure, they want to prop up the system that allows them to be rich, so they want to have like lower taxes and less regulation on industries. But some of them don't. Some of them actually want more taxes. Some of them want more regulation. So it's not like you've got all these people who are agreeing on what to do. They're each basing their actions on their own individual desires and their own individual philosophies and ideologies. And it's all different. And what comes out is, you know, the mess that we see in government, which is, you know, basically being influenced by all these lobbyists. But there are all these different lobbyists who are trying to get different things. It's not like they're all trying to do exactly the same thing. You get environment industry, the environment movement lobbyists. You get oil industry lobbyists, and then you get people in the tech industry, and they're all going for different things, and they're all going for their own things. They're not going for the goals of the Illuminati. They're going for the goals of Bill Gates, or the goals of Mark Zuckerberg, or the goals of Eldon Sheldon, whatever his name is, the casino guy. Just try to tell people about this. Try to give them a broader basis of understanding of the world, and hopefully it will take after a while.
Because I think some of this, to me, is largely, they hear it over and over again from politicians, whether it's Corbyn or Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, where they're always saying rigged, mm-hmm. Everything is rigged, and it's they did it, it's that group, the 1% or some other rich group that did it. And it sort of leaves out the messiness of the system. And even then, you still hear these theories that are so convoluted, like Bernie Sanders, for example, says the 1% rigged the entire system, so only they win. Then out of the other side of his mouth, he'll say they're free market gamblers. And it's just like, well, it can't be both, right? But it's just he's appealing to this anti-rich, anti-elitist viewpoint that to me doesn't have so much to do with the rationality of the theory itself, but just with this anti-elite sentiment. And yeah. I wonder how do you overcome that? It's not that I want people to trust elites all the time. We shouldn't. Particularly political elites, but at the same token, we shouldn't be automatically biased against them and think they're, conspirators in some mass plot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think with Bernie Sanders, he has to simplify things, and he has to amplify certain things. So what you're getting from him or even people like Elizabeth Warren, is going to be, to a degree, a simplification of something that they're trying to present a certain case. And the problem is that most people aren't really that interested in the details of these things. Mm. They'd like to have someone to dislike. They like to have an enemy. And it's quite difficult to actually explain the workings of government and industry and the military-industrial complex or the tech-industrial complex, which is actually how Washington works. People talk about the deep state as if there's some kind of secret cabal of liberals running Hollywood and the military. But really, the deep state is really the military-industrial complex and Washington, the Washington machine for getting policy done, getting laws changed, getting regulations changed, getting taxes changed, and the lobbyists from industry, and then the revolving door that we have in Washington, where people get jobs in regulatory agencies, in part because of their experience in an industry, and then they work there, perhaps do some favors for their friends, and then they leave, and then they get a job in the industry that they were once regulating. Mm-hmm. This is really the fundamental problem with American politics, is that we've got this huge symbiotic relationship between industry and government. And I think that is something that you can focus on as being a very real problem and that people can actually get their teeth into. And this is one of the things I try to steer people towards. A large part of why I try to debunk conspiracy theories is that I want them to focus on real issues. Mm. And this problem of our essentially corrupt government, de facto corrupt, even if the individuals themselves, some of them are very well-meaning, is a real problem. And if you can point that out to people who are once conspiracy theorists and activists, they might move over and start trying to do something about that.
So it's about getting rid of people's conspiracy theories, but instead replacing them with more real, more tangible, more evidence-based problems that they could work on solving.
Indeed, which in some cases are actual conspiracies that you could say, in a way, like politicians taking bribes to create legislation is a conspiracy theory. But we all know that that's essentially what happens, that they are influenced by various lobbies and campaign contributions, and their legislation does result from that. So it's a conspiracy theory, but it's an extremely well-founded one. It's right at the bottom of the conspiracy theory scale, and it's something I think that we can get the actual conspiracy theorists, like 9/11 conspiracy theorists, and even chemtrail conspiracy theorists, even flat earthers, if we can push them towards that end of the conspiracy spectrum, then we'll be able to do some good.
Okay, let's give people your contact information. Now, you have a podcast and a website, so perhaps give that out so people can listen if they want to hear more.
Yeah, my podcast is Tales from the Rabbit Hole, which you can get at tftrh.com. And my website is metabunk.org. And you can find me online on Twitter and Facebook at Mick West. And that's it.
Okay, we'll have that linked up as well as your book on our own website. And thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. It's been very interesting.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. and is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real, frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.